Hi, volleyball fans, and welcome back to Volley Talk, the podcast created for volleyball lovers who want to dig deep into what is going on in NCAA and international volleyball. I'm your host, Sarah Pavin. I'm an Olympian, beach volleyball world champion, former Nebraska Cornhusker, and longtime pro, both indoor and on the beach.
And I'm Adam Schultz, former indoor player, international volleyball coach, and the show's resident stat guy.
We were back to our regularly scheduled programming on the love side of things this week, and PVF mixed things up and had their all-star game on Saturday in Indianapolis. NCAA men's is still in full swing. There were a lot of interesting results that we will touch on shortly. The Champions League quarterfinals are set for women, and today we're just going to try to close out February with a bang here. Adam has a new game for us. You know he loves to mix it up. We've got several listener questions. My voice might be a little creaky because I called that five-setter between UCLA and UCI last night. So if I'm a little hoarse, you know why. But
I will say you did a really good job.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun, actually. We've got a lot to get covered. Don't want to keep you waiting. So let's get started. All right, the weekly highlights, happenings. Probably less happenings, more highlights, because this week was a calm week. We're just playing volleyball here, everybody. You know we love those weeks. You know we also love the drama, probably more than we should. But today is just results. So for Champions League, since we've gotten so many requests to touch more on European leagues, the men are still in the playoff phase, so they're trying to determine which teams are still going to be in the quarterfinals. But the women's quarterfinals are set. We've got, and these Polish, I'm not going to pronounce the Polish cities the best, but I'll try. We've got Lodz versus Savino Del Bene Scandici. Vakıf Bank is taking on Fenerbahce. Conigliano is playing Rzeszów, and Izazibashi is playing Milano. So we've got three Turkish teams, three Italian teams, two Polish teams for the final eight. And how it works is each team plays at home, then they play away. If the matches are split, they play a golden set. And the winner of the golden set takes all and goes to the semifinals. So those are actually starting this week. So Lodz and Scandici, Vakıf Bank, Fenerbahce, their first round of their like back-to-back is actually happening this Wednesday. So it's on Eurovolley.tv if you want to check those out. All right, NCAA men's side. Long Beach State is the only unbeaten team left, everybody. Because number three UCLA beat number two UC Irvine, who was the other unbeaten team. They beat them twice this week. 3-0 in Irvine, 3-2 in Westwood. We watched both of those.
One of them in person.
Of course this happened the week after I say, I think UC Irvine's better than Long Beach State. Of course that happened. I love UC Irvine. I think they're so good. But this week, I'm like left, like, dang it. Yeah, I just said that last week, and well, here we are.
I think there were a few things that were surprising in these matches. One is the match where UCLA won 3-0 in Irvine. They all of a sudden just decided that middle was going to be their favorite attack of the year moving forward.
After literally never setting them at all. It was almost painful watching Rowan and Thorne trying to connect up until that point. Like, Rowan kept undersetting Thorne, like it was too low, so then they just like didn't bother, and then all of a sudden they were like all world.
It was night and day difference. I think Thorne got 10 kills.
15 in the first match, like 18 or 17 in the second. Both career highs.
Yeah, it was wild to watch. And not only that, Rowan was forcing the middle on passes near the attack line. It was a complete switch. And I don't know if this was game plan specifically against UC Irvine because they have a first-year middle who hasn't played a ton of volleyball. I don't know if this is something they've been working towards, knowing they have to run the middle more. I don't know if they listened to our podcast last week.
I mean, obviously, that tipped the balance, you know.
But we have been saying if UCLA can run their middle, they're going to be a much more dangerous team. And not to mention, David was back. Didn't play great in UC Irvine, but he's just a presence on the floor and something you have to think about. He played better at UCLA yesterday. But if their middles are going, they're very, very good. Watching that match live, their only weakness when everybody is playing well, in my opinion, is their reception libero, who needs to find a little more consistency. I think he gave up a bunch of bad aces.
I would argue both liberos are their weak spot. They're at the bottom of the MPSF in digs per set.
Fair.
Like, they don't dig much, and I agree, their reception libero, Kirchy, like, he gets aced a lot.
If you had one player that you could kind of fix, it would be Kirchy, in my opinion.
Well, rumor has it, if you guys follow UCLA, that Miles Partain, if he gets cleared to play and come back, he is going to be playing libero.
From what I saw this past week from UCLA, if they continue trending in this direction, they're going to be very, very good. And on the flip side, watching UC Irvine, they looked a little one-dimensional to me this week. I didn't think they ran the middles particularly well. I thought that Flexen struggled this week, and partially because it looked like they kept undersetting him. I do not think their setter played particularly well this week. He struggled to connect with all of the hitters, in my opinion, and I didn't love his decision-making. They still passed really well, but UCLA made them seem a little one-dimensional. Flexen didn't play particularly well. The middles didn't score. Their second left side didn't...
Literally did not score, like, at all.
And so you're left with, yes, an amazing player, but you need more than one person scoring points for you.
They definitely had trouble connecting their offense this week. Everybody looked a little out of rhythm. I agree. Flexen was getting set inside a lot and in out of system situations. Like, it wasn't good. I mean, even watching live, it's like Henno was getting set tight, then he was getting set low, and then it was too, like, it was just messy from an offensive perspective. And then because, like you were saying before, because UCLA was running their middle so much, I think it really highlighted, A, how undersized UCI's middles are. They're both 1'6'4", 1'6'6". And granted, Cam Thorne is 6'4 for UCLA too, but he touches like 11'10". So, like, not really undersized.
Freak athlete.
And then it also highlighted, in particular, Micah Goss, his inexperience.
Yeah.
He just didn't know what to do. He could not figure out how to block Thorne. What, like, offensively he did okay, but, like, he looked a little overwhelmed. And then on top of that, you see Henno getting frustrated because he's not getting set properly. Like, Flexen is having trouble getting going. And let me tell you, he was ABCA National Player of the Week this week. It is hard to replicate great performances after getting that title. Yeah, he did not have a good week.
I'm not ready to write off UC Irvine. Like, obviously, they're still a good team. They have great players. But it was just an interesting shift in perception for me between those two teams, kind of highlighting what UCLA can look like when everything is clicking, but also what UCI looks like when things aren't going well for them, because they have been very good up until this point of the season. So it's interesting.
Well, in the first game as well, Sean McQuiggan, who had, it was only his second match of the season, hit 1,000.
He was unbelievable.
10 for 10. Second UCLA player in history to do that, by the way. And with a storied program like UCLA, that says a lot. He was not effective yesterday. He didn't score many points. He made errors, stuff like that. But the crazy thing is, even though he wasn't scoring, he kept drawing the middle with him. They were respecting him so much, which opened things up completely. Like, David had one-on-ones. He had no block sometimes. Like, the outsides on the BIC were hitting with no block. And so at one point, McQuiggan got pulled. And I was shocked because I'm like, yes, he's not scoring, But he is distracting the middles from the other team. Like, keep him in there as a decoy.
David needs to buy him a beer because he had a couple free swings. Let me tell you, that is a thank you very much situation.
If I saw David, that man, coming at me with no block, I would run away.
Henna turtled. In one match, he put his hands over his head and just
No, thank you.
And I don't blame him.
It was, I mean, Wednesday wasn't a great game. Like, you see, I just looked off. I think Saturday's game, it was a really good game.
Minus the fourth set. It was a very good game.
The fourth set was rough. UCLA kind of ran away with it. But overall, like, you didn't see anything glaring like, this is really bad. Like, it was a good match to watch.
Agreed. Agreed.
Number 8 Grand Canyon had a tough week. They lost 3-1 to number 12 Northridge. And then they lost 3-0 to Long Beach State. Long Beach State loss, probably not unexpected. But the CSUN match, they probably want that one back. They also did lose their coach, who just like peaced out this week to go be the associate head coach for the Kansas women's program. Like, I'm sorry. Are you telling me you can't finish out this season? You're just going to leave your team high and dry halfway through the season and be like, goodbye.
That's a really tough blow to the team, to the culture, to the environment. I'm not surprised they lost the game after that happened. You feel abandoned. You've worked towards this the whole time. I mean, we don't know the situation around it, but you got to handle that and leave your team in a good position, in my opinion.
I feel like from Kansas's side, it's like, I understand you're in spring season and stuff. You want the girls to get to know your the coaching staff, but like, he can't show up in May. You know?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that's a little unreasonable. And then the fact that he just, like, again, we don't know the details of, like, his contract, his obligations and stuff. But on a human level, you would think that you would want to see this through with these guys, particularly the ones that came and were, like, recruited by you.
And you're a good program. Like, it's not like he left a program that was struggling or didn't have a chance. Like, yeah, the whole situation seems strange to me.
So, am I shocked that they had these losses? No, it's probably a huge blow, but it still sucks. Like, I feel bad for them, honestly. Yeah. Number 17, McKendry, continues to just ruin people's weeks, okay? They upset Lewis a couple weeks ago. Then they upset Loyola Chicago. This week, the victims were number 15, Ohio State. They beat them in 4. And then on Saturday, they beat number 8, Ball State in 5.
I want to know when McKendry is going to be a top 10 team because they just keep winning.
Here we are. Penn State can't buy a win, and they're somehow hanging around in the top 20 still. McKendry just keeps knocking off teams left and right, and they're like, you know what? You deserve a solid 17. Congratulations. Like, at some point, these guys have got to, like, move up a little further, but that's just me. Speaking of Penn State, they are still riding that struggle bus, everybody. They lost to NJIT. I don't even know what that is. I'm gonna guess it's New Jersey Institute of Technology. I just completely made that up, but tell me if I'm right or wrong. They lost 3 straight to these guys, but then they turned around and beat them in 4 the next day. As I said, how are they still ranked? If they don't drop out of the top 20 this week, I'm punching my computer screen. You know what I mean?
It's the legacy vote. Program history.
Well, yeah. Anyway, number 20, Princeton lost to Charleston, West Virginia, 3-1. They did come back and beat them in 4 the next match. Again, Penn State and Princeton, you need to drop out of this list. Let's bring in some other teams here, okay? Because you haven't proven that you deserve to stay there. The top 5 has stayed pretty consistent for the last few weeks, but we're probably going to see a change, namely maybe UCLA taking over the number 2 spot, flip-flopping with UC Irvine. Will Irvine drop more than one spot because of those losses? Who knows?
My instinct is that they'll drop below Hawaii. I think they'll go to 4.
Oh. You know what? I think that's a good call.
Yeah.
I think that's fair. They lost 2 in a row. Like, if they had split, they might have been able to hold on to the 3 spot, but... Or even the 2 they might have been able to hold on to.
I think if they had gone into UCLA and won in 3 or 4, they probably would have stayed at 2. But to lose both, you're going to drop.
I think overall, the top 5 is going to change. We're going to see some change in the top 10. So let's see what happens on Monday.
This week we had a bit of a change in the normal Love schedule. They played more during the week than on the weekend. And for our head-to-head match, we saw Atlanta beating Madison in five, which was shocking only because Madison won a few sets, but they're still in the loss category.
Adam is so nice about everything except when it comes to Love Madison, and then he just turns savage.
Well, I'll be honest. I looked at their roster, and I looked at Furbringer going there to be the coach, and I just thought they were going to be better. They just have not figured out how to win, and I'm shocked. Quite frankly, I keep expecting them to turn it around, and I keep being surprised.
I mean, I've said it numerous times. I had them in my top three preseason, and I'm so embarrassed. I'm so embarrassed that I said that. I'm like, come on, everybody. I didn't mean it.
For our weekend slash week with Love, we had Austin beat Houston 3-1. Now, a little caveat here for anyone who didn't watch the game is that Houston didn't play a ton of their starters. They actually won the All-Star weekend, so I think they gave a few players the match off.
What was it, like Amber Igeed and Jess Merzlik were like the only two
I believe
played
so.
Or something? Yeah.
So not surprising that Austin beat them with half their lineup. But then we saw Houston go in and beat Omaha 3-0 after that, and they played their starters. So I wouldn't read too much into that loss. They looked pretty good. We watched that Omaha match, and we'll talk about it later. And then the final match, we had Austin beat Salt Lake 3-1. So if we look at the updated standings, you have Atlanta still one, Houston followed by Omaha, Austin, Salt Lake, and Madison bringing up the rear. And they're not even close.
Not even close. But nobody's close to Atlanta either, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to finish the season on top, though. I think Houston is going to keep
Houston
climbing.
Houston is good. I would say Houston's probably my favorite Love team.
I would agree with you. Looking at the PVF, we had the All-Star match this week, which looked like it went really well. There were about 7,000 people there. The atmosphere looked great. The press around it looked good. We didn't have a chance to watch the match just because we were watching the men's match.
We're watching the men's match. And we know how I feel about All-Star matches. They just stress me out.
Fair enough. We did have Charity Looper and Kylie Murr added to the rosters last minute. Looper replaced Mebra Mena, who was injured. And they brought in Kylie Murr just to give them another libero option at the event. Team Shondell won, which was good to see. There was a good turnout there, like we said.
I didn't really understand the format, though. Did you read that? It was like they had to play three sets, but then when Team Shondell won the first two, they only needed 8 points to win.
So the set victories didn't matter. It was total points for and against, I believe.
So they just had to get to 58? Like, why 58?
Well, at that point, because they won the first two sets, if they got to 8... the other team couldn't get to
no,
their
but
point
it was
total.
Like 25-20, 25-22. Like, it wasn't crazy.
Yeah, I didn't look into it that closely.
Okay, I was trying to figure it out because I'm like, okay, at the end of the first two sets, it was 50-42.
8±, I don't know.
Anyway, if you know, please tell us.
So that was good for them, and I was glad that it went off well. This was the first pro volleyball match to be shown on traditional American TV, which is a really cool first for the league.
For our sport, even.
Exactly. And so congrats to PVF. You know, as much as we talk about maybe the level or how they're doing, they are continuing to work in a good manner and push forward, and it's really good to see. Now, we have big news. Columbus has had their coming out party. They are winning matches.
And wow.
We will talk about, so we watched them play the Vegas Thrill after we saw that they won. We're like, hey, let's check this out and see what's going on.
They were the only team we haven't seen play.
Yeah. And so it kind of fit that it worked out well. We'll talk about them. I was pleasantly surprised watching that match, but we'll get into that later. So Vegas, who lost to Columbus, is now struggling. They were leading the league last week, but now they've dropped two in a row, both to Columbus and Orlando. Omaha has beaten San Diego twice in a row. now, and San Diego finds themselves in a tailspin, possibly going to drop below Columbus.
No, they are below Columbus already. They're tied in record, but they have one less point.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, because I looked on the, I thought I looked on the stats yesterday, and they were still last, so they've dropped. Okay. Now, Omaha has the top seed at 8-3, followed by Orlando, Vegas, and then Indy. Columbus, obviously not in last place anymore, which I thought they still were.
Just needed two in a row, baby. They just needed three wins.
So we're starting to see some movement in PVF, which is what you want to see. Teams moving in the standings. There's a little bit of adjustments. Teams are kind of starting to settle in. I enjoyed watching the PVF this week. I'm not going
to
lie.
It's time to dive into our matches of the week. Our first one is Love Omaha versus Love Houston. My initial impression watching this was it looked a little uninspired. There didn't seem to be a ton of energy on the court. It seemed a little flat. But I have been known to be a little harsh, so why don't you tell me what you think?
Well, I think looking at the scores, the game looked closer than it actually was watching it on TV. You had Houston was in control of that match from the get-go. I think they gave up 4 and 5 points respectively at the end of both the first and the second set. So even though it ended, you know, 26-24, 25-23, I believe, Houston only ever just needed one more side out. And for me watching it, there was never really any question as to who was going to win those sets.
Yeah, it's true. I think at the end of one set, it was what, like 23-19 or something?
Yeah. And then it was like 26-24. Yeah.
And then the same story. I think, as you were saying, the score of the third set is how the whole match felt.
Yes. I never really felt like Omaha was in the match or threatening to win. I thought at the beginning of the season, looking at the Omaha roster, that they were going to be consistent, but they weren't going to beat you. And watching them play throughout the season, I think they were the team that gelled the fastest out of all of the teams in Love. And I think they got some early wins. And we kind of talked about being surprised that they were winning matches and how well they were playing. And I think you're starting to see them come back down to earth a little bit. There was an injury in the middle. So Stivrens is now playing middle, which is fine. She's a great middle. But in the position she's in, she's not running the slide. So she's not quite as effective. I think you're seeing Winters struggling to pass a little bit. So they're not in system. It's just not as clean. And watching them play, they're having trouble scoring points now that teams kind of know what to expect from them. And Jordan is still their best player, in my opinion. And she can't be your best offensive player. And to her credit, watching her play, as soon as the defense moves, she knows where to put the ball and she can score. She's not blowing anybody up, but her vision and ability to kind of wait off the defense is allowing her to score. That being said, I think for Houston, you're starting to see Massimo Barbellini's coaching style settle in. Houston is in good position defensively. You're starting to see them play the way he wants them to play and finding an offense and finding a defense. And I think for me, watching their progression, you're starting to see his influence on the team and they're starting to become his team.
I mean, Massimo Barbellini's an incredible coach. He has won world championships, everything. So I think that the way that it really showed itself to me was seeing him blatantly telling his players to tip the ball. We noticed it right off the hop. Like, this was for sure a game plan decision, but Omaha was not covering the tips well at all. And you could see as the game kept going and went in tight moments when there was a timeout, he was telling them to tip, and it was landing consistently.
Yeah, and I think this to me is where you start seeing some of the coaching experience. I think Susie Fritz has done a really good job of bringing her team together, but Omaha was defending the perimeter of the court, which, again, makes sense because you have Jordan Thompson, who's a good perimeter swinger. You have Jess Mirzick, who's a good perimeter swinger. Like, the game plan, given the players you're playing against, was solid, but there was no adjustment when they were being exploited.
Well, and it's just obvious that Barbolini got ahead of that because, 100%. Like, within the first 5 points, they were tipping. And it's just, like, that type of preparation and seeing those trends, like, he has that experience. And I just, like, I really like how he's running his team. So, yeah, the tip defense from Omaha was a huge red flag to me, like, immediately. The other thing, and you just talked about it a little bit, was, like, I am a Lauren Stivers fan. I think she's very good. However, she needs to be running off of one foot. She is not a two-footed middle attacker, which is why I really liked her in the role she had for Omaha, because as the right side coming in, she was able to run that slide even from the right side position. But the fact that they're insisting on continuing with the 6'2", even though Candelaria Herrera is injured, it doesn't really make sense to me. I would almost rather see them run a traditional 5-1 and allow Stivers to do what she's the best at.
If you look at Love Omaha, you still have Winters and Drevniak scoring the most points at 13 apiece. Like, they are going to be your point scorers, but watching them, they're not getting the team out of trouble. So even though they're scoring more points than Larson is, they don't have somebody who they can just count on to go up and hit a high ball or hit an out-of-system ball, other than Jordan, who can kind of move the ball around. But again, as you start to play against teams that kind of see what you're doing, that's going to become harder and harder. And I think you're going to see Omaha struggle in these situations. And at the same time, Winters being served so much, that tip defense, she looked out of place to me on some of those balls, didn't really pick them up, didn't see what was happening.
I think it was everybody. It was the setters, Dikema, it was Jordan when she was front row, it was Winter. Like, everybody was struggling to pick up these tips.
So you think that was less of a player decision and more of a game plan decision that they were doing?
Yeah, I just don't think that they were expecting it, and they didn't make that adjustment. I like Drevniak, though. I think she does swing well. And I do like her out of system. But again, you could see the Houston game plan shine in just how many blocks they got. And I don't know if that was a big difference in the stats, but just watching, Omaha got blocked a lot.
So it's interesting that that was the feel of your...
I'm always wrong.
Well, no, it was 7-7. So the block totals were even.
Okay, those blocks were coming back fast. And you talk about, like, the out-of-system hitting. I personally like Drevniak's out-of-system hitting, but... And I know I'm not a Winters fan, so this might be a hot take, but to me, it looks like she just closes her eyes and hits it as hard as she can. There doesn't seem to be a lot of intention or creativity behind her offense. And I think that's a big reason why she gets blocked so hard.
Yeah, she's... But I think they're asking her to be their terminal player.
No, it has to be Drevniak for me. I think Drevniak has better range. I think she sees the game better. Like,
but again, as they're running a 6-2, she's not on the floor all the time.
Fair.
So who else is it going to be? And this is where I think Omaha has to figure out what their identity is going to be. Are you sticking with the 6-2 just to stick with it, even though you have a middle who's injured? Are you going to go back to it? Are you going to find a 5-1? Like, to me, depending on what the injury is and how long Candelari is going to be out, they need to figure out how they're going to operate.
On the flip side, Houston, we talked about their game plan. We talked about Barbolini. I'm a huge fan. They did look a little fatigued, particularly Jess Mirzick. She's young, she can handle it, but she gets a ton of balls and she's playing every single match. I think they said they played 5 matches in 7 days.
Yeah.
Again, when you're playing that often, you have like a 1 hour serve and pass and then you play the match. Like, is it incredibly grueling? In my opinion, no. It's harder to practice every single day a couple times a day, but she definitely looked fatigued.
But the thing that Houston is doing well is they don't rely on one player. Yes, they have Jordan Thompson, who has been playing very well these last couple weeks. She looks like she has found her rhythm, and she was the player of the match. She is pretty much unstoppable at this point in the league. And she hit 486 on the match. She had 23 points. So even though Jess Mrzek did look fatigued and not having quite as much lift or power as she normally does, they don't need her to be that player all the time because they have Jordan Thompson. And Omaha clearly wanted to wear Mrzek down. They served her short. They served her every ball. And it looked like she was able to just focus in. I'm going to take care of these balls, and I know I don't have to carry the load. And being able to split your team, they have two very good hitters on the outside of the pins with both her and Jordan Thompson. Houston doesn't need both of them to be all world to win at any given time, which I think is a huge strength. And Maddie Rischel is holding her own. They don't have to rely on her for a ton of points, but she's contributing. The one thing I will say about Houston is I think they need to get their middles a few more balls. Jordan Thompson has been able to score against the double block pretty consistently, but at some point you want to have a threat in the middle. And that would be my guess as to where they go and what they're working on currently.
I think Ajeed has consistently been getting better as the season's progressed. I believe they rested Rafaela fully because we saw Christina Bauer coming in. They didn't use Bauer much. But, I mean, I played against Christina Bauer overseas for years, and she was never the offensive middle. She was more of the blocking middle. But, yeah, I agree. It's nice to see Jordan Thompson kind of, like, find her rhythm and come into her own again. But if Houston can consistently get their middles going, too, like, nobody will stop them.
IG'd only got 9 sets.
I think she's playing well, though.
I agree. But they need to have her be more involved. Yeah. She needs to be more of a threat. And so my guess would be that's something that they're going to continue to work on now that they've ironed out the Jordan Thompson
consistency issues.
Correct. Yeah. I think Houston is going to be at the top of the league come the end of the season.
Well, they beat Atlanta in the final of that tournament last week.
Watching them, for me, I think I like how they're training. I see them getting better. You can see the purpose of what they're doing. They're buying in. They're going to be my pick to be at the top of the league come the end of the season.
Our second match of the week is PVF, Vegas Thrill versus Columbus Fury. As we mentioned earlier in the show, we haven't watched Columbus play yet, mostly because they were just losing every single game. But after they got their second win of the season versus Vegas, we were like, we should probably check them out. And watching them, they were actually pretty good.
Watching that match against Vegas, I was shocked that they didn't have any wins yet, or very few wins.
Yeah, did you do research into what has been happening with them?
Yeah, so I was mostly curious about their roster composition in terms of who's been playing sets while they're losing. Here's just a little background information for those of you who haven't been watching Columbus play. So Raposh played very well in this match against Vegas on the right side. I thought she was the reason they won the game.
Unconscious. She was unconscious. She couldn't do anything wrong.
Unbelievable. She only hit 196.
What?
On the match.
Oh well, God, like she was the best in the world.
She was very good, but she had a 37% kill ratio. The only reason her numbers are so bad, she only made 2 errors. She was blocked 7 times.
Oh baby.
So you know, she was going to be terminal and she was swinging.
The play was ending when she was hitting it, regardless of who scored it.
Well, I think she got blocked 3 or 4 times in that set that they lost. And because she got set a ton of balls. So to me, those numbers are a little misleading.
I mean, getting blocked 7 times is a lot. I don't think there's anything misleading about that.
But my point was it happened in one set.
I understand.
Okay. Yeah. So she's only, if we look at the matches that they've lost, she started about half of those matches. So it looks to me like they were trying to figure out who was playing. Lewis was their other opposite.
Okay.
So it looked like they were trying to figure out what was going to happen there. And that also happened with the setter position. So you had Rivera has started all of the matches they won, but she's only played, again, close to half of the matches or started half the matches as their other setter, Stringer.
I was actually wondering about that. I was surprised to see Tori Stringer on the bench. She only came in for a few points, but yeah, that explains it. I didn't know that.
So basically, Cox and Lush, who are the outside hitters, have played almost all of their matches. So they've been staples on the floor with Terry coming in and rotating through. So they're pretty set on the left side position, but it looks like the coach tinkers based off how that's going.
But Terry was the one playing
correct
against Vegas.
So this will be really interesting. So it looks like they're kind of set there, but they're rotating between those three. Their middles have been solid. Rammelsberg and Walker have pretty much played the whole season, so they're locked in there. But to me, it's that opposite setter combination that they're trying to figure out. And for all of their wins, Rapoch and Rivera have been playing. So I think you're going to see that lineup stick together, and I think you're going to see them perform much better moving on in the season. They're my dark horse team. I really liked watching Rivera set. I think her release is good. I think she was consistent. I really liked her decision-making. Watching them for the first time, I don't think there was a comparison between setters.
I mean, I haven't watched Columbus at all this year, and I haven't seen Stringer play enough recently to really be able to comment on that. But interesting, two former Louisville setters.
I was looking at that too.
Woo. I mean, we've seen different teams kind of tinkering with their lineup. I think certain teams obviously found their lineup quicker than others. Columbus seems to be a little slower in figuring that out, but I think now maybe they've kind of settled on something, and hopefully we'll see them win a few more games. They've now beaten Grand Rapids twice and Vegas once, so hopefully they will continue. But going back to the actual game, they looked good. They looked solid. I, when we were watching, was like, wow, Raina Terry's making a ton of errors. But then you were like, no, she's not.
I thought Raina Terry was playing better than she was. Your instinct on this was actually right.
I'm shocked.
She made seven errors and hit 143. But I thought she was attacking well. She looked in rhythm. It looked like she was scoring points for them, but the numbers didn't back up my eye test on this one.
Wow, I'm always wrong on this. I'm shocked. They ran their middle consistently. I think Rivera and Walker had a really good connection. She was scoring a lot of points. Rammelsberg, her serving. I think at one point she had four aces in a row.
To close out a set.
Yeah. Megan Lush, she's definitely the veteran on that team. She was consistent. She, you know, did her job. She held down the fort, so to speak. She wasn't like outstanding to me, but she was just like steady, which I think when you have a team that's having trouble finding wins, you just need some players that are just that steady piece.
So the thing for me that was interesting, I was curious if this win for them, their outside hitters played significantly better than they had on average in the season. Like, was this an anomaly?
Oh, or I thought checked that.
I did check that.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, so that's perfect. That was kind of my question going in. It's like, okay, is this an anomaly for Columbus? Like, did they just play way better than they ever have? And are they going to come back down to earth? And that's actually not the case. So Lush played a little bit better than she has historically on the season. On the season, she's hit 136. And in this match, she hit 267. So she
could
played,
that be a setting thing? Because they, who knows?
It definitely could be. But she played significantly better than she has from an attack standpoint.
Which sucks because I'm like, she was fine. She was just steady.
Well, I mean, 179 is not really where you want to be. No. Like 267 is good. Now, Rapoch played pretty much the same as she's played all season. So she's 179 on the season, and she hit 196 in this match. So close. And again, we talked about the blocks, but I thought that she was the spark plug for them, and I didn't think they would win that match without her.
No.
Terry actually played worse than her season stats. So on the season, she's 163, and in that match, she hit 143. So she was a little bit worse. but they're all kind of within that range. So I don't think their performance...
These numbers are actually terrible.
Yeah, they're not great. Well, but they've been losing, right?
Well, I think that is like, here we are like, oh, Columbus isn't that bad. Maybe Vegas was like just that bad.
Well,
but continue.
Here's the difference. So their middles played significantly better than they've played all season. So Ramelsberg hits 277 on the season. She hit 438 on this one. And Walker hits 258 on the season. She hit 412. And they got set 16 and 17 times. So they made a push to run the middle, and their middles played well.
They're proving what Adam and I preach week in and week out. If your middle is running well, you're going to be fine.
So to me, that's going to be their kind of golden ticket to a few more wins as the season progresses. And I'm hoping, watching that match, they stick with Rivera. I thought she did a good job running the middle. Like I said, I liked her decisions. If they can continue finding a combination between their left sides of who's playing well, and I mean, Rapoche at 179, under 200, like she doesn't have to be a world beater, and they can still win, and you know, maybe she won't get blocked quite so many times, but I think that they have the makeup of a team that should be winning more matches than they have up to this point, and I would expect them to do that moving forward.
It's just crazy what their season numbers are. I know they've lost a lot, so like whatever, but even the game that they won, like their numbers are not good for their outsides, and it's crazy that I'm sitting here like, oh, they looked pretty good. Like I was surprised. They look solid. It's like, that's still not a good performance, but your middles held you together.
Well, and I think part of it is about expectation, right? They haven't won anything. They're at the bottom of the league. You expect them to be terrible given their record. And that was just not the case. Now, fair. Curious how their setting has been previous to this, but that was good in this match. And I will say, Vegas struggled to pass.
I was just going to say that. Wow. Alicia Childress was literally trying to run everywhere. She could not get to these balls. The passes were spraying all over the court.
She was more track athlete than setter.
She was on the ground a lot.
Yeah, it was hard to watch. Like, I felt bad.
I felt for her. So bad for her. I'm like, she did not sign up for this, everybody.
No. Congrats to Columbus for applying service pressure and being able to pull that out. I'm curious if their serving isn't quite that good. Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, you saw, we were talking about Columbus trying to find what works. You saw Vegas trying anything to figure out what would work in this match. So, I mean, they started with Hannah Maddox. She got yanked pretty early, and Allison Mayfield was subbed in. They started with Morgan Stout in the middle. She got yanked early. Lane Van Buskirk got put in. Tegan DeFalco got subbed out for Mary Schroll in the libero. But like, they were just doing like a in and out, trying to find something that would work. Obviously, from the passing standpoint with their left side and libero, but even in the middle, like, they were desperate.
Yeah, and you can't, if you're passing like that, your middles are going to be ineffective and not get set, which was definitely the case. They relied on Charity Looper and Cameron Hanna to try and win that match for them, and they played pretty well. Looper hit 229 on 35 attacks, and Hanna was 200 on 35. But let me tell you, they were facing a double block almost all night. You knew where the ball
they
was
were
going.
Not getting set.
It was well. It was tough. And other than that, they didn't set many other people. Both Cameron Hanna and Charity Looper both got 35 sets, and the middles were sitting at 12 and 15. So, I mean, what are you going to do? You're relying on two players.
With bad passes and not great sets because she couldn't get to those passes. It just, yeah, it was not the Vegas that we have seen of late. They did have that hiatus because they had so many more games than everybody else. They kind of had almost a full week off without games. Again, is that an excuse? Absolutely not. But they did not look as sharp as they have in the past.
So for me, happy to see Columbus get a win.
You love a win.
Definitely thought watching that match in isolation that they were good enough to get other wins. So we'll see if that keeps going. I hope that they stick with this lineup. I think it has potential for them. I'm expecting Vegas to get back on the right side of things. If they can pass, Childress is obviously a great setter. She knows what she's doing. So once that happens, I'm curious to see Columbus continue. I think they're going to win more matches than they have to this point. And I would expect Vegas to be fighting for the top of the league still. All right, so now it's time for my favorite segment. So today, I think for me, there's been a few things that have happened that have been maybe eyebrow raising or have left with questions. So we're going to play something I'm going to call more surprised. So I'm going to give you a scenario or two scenarios, and you are going to tell me which one surprises you more and why. Okay. So the first one is, are you more surprised that Long Beach State is still undefeated or that UCLA won both matches against UCI today?
Simple. The fact that UCLA beat UCI twice. I mean, Long Beach State's a great team. I'm not shocked that they're undefeated so far. But I fully expected UC Irvine to beat UCLA in the second match. I really, really like that team. I think that when they're firing and when their offense is clicking, they are so good. And I'll say it again. I said last week, I think that when they're playing well, they are better than Long Beach State. Of course, they had to go prove me wrong, whatever. I'm not bitter about it. But maybe a little. But I was shocked to see them drop two in a row.
I would agree with you. Given who Long Beach was playing, now they've beaten some good teams, but they've had a couple easier games these last...
UCI's schedule has been crazy.
Yeah. And I definitely thought that UCI was going to win at least one, if not both, of the matches against UCLA, especially given how UCLA has kind of been playing lately. So I would agree that the UCLA double win was more surprising for me. Okay, question two, and we've talked about this. Are you more surprised, now take yourself back to the beginning of the season, that Atlanta is in first place for Love with 7 wins, or Madison is in dead last with 1 win? Which of those two things is more surprising?
Because I, going into this season, I thought Madison would be at the top. I literally thought Atlanta would be at the bottom. So both are quite surprising to me. I think, okay, if I logic this out, I think the fact that I had Madison in my top three, but then Atlanta at the bottom, I would have to say I'm more surprised that Atlanta is at the top. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no.
Because I didn't have Madison necessarily at the top. They were just in that top group. So I think the fact that it's Atlanta at the top, I'm very surprised. When I was looking through their roster at the beginning of the year, I'm like, no, they just don't have it. To be fair, I thought, probably like many people, that Catino would be playing right side all season. I didn't know who Grubbs was at all, not gonna lie, but she has really come into her own, and they've, like, different players that I had no clue who they are have been stepping up, which was completely unexpected.
I'm gonna go the other way with this. When I looked at Madison's roster, and you know, Matt Furbringer has obviously been in the game for a long time, has experienced a lot of success, I thought that combination of coach and team was a lock to be super competitive. And for them to be at the bottom with 1 win and just not very good, I'm shocked at that. You know, you look at these rosters, and I think they were created with the intention of being pretty equal. And so, you know, a couple of players stand out. Like you said, a couple of people you didn't know play well. I think any team had the potential to kind of hit the top of the league. So for me, Madison being as bad as they are, that's a huge surprise to me. Okay, the next question, we're going to stay with Love here. 3 of the top 5 point scorers in Love are rookies. Are you more surprised that the rookies have been as good as they are? And for those who aren't paying super close attention, it's Madison Skinner, Mrzyk, and actually Mrzyk and Franklin are tied, I think, as of right now, with 107 points each for 4th best in the league. So are you surprised that the rookies are making as much noise at the top of those lists as they are? Or are you more surprised that the other veterans, foreigners that they brought in haven't been making as much of an impact as you kind of would think they would have at the beginning of the season.
Dang, Adam. You really did your homework this week. These are good questions. Okay, when I think about this, the veteran players, the foreign players that were brought into Love are the ones who are kind of at the tail end of their career. They're kind of on their way out. So I'm more surprised that the rookies are performing as well as they are. I think there's definitely a jump and some adjustments to be made going from the college game to the pro game. And honestly, I thought it would take them longer than it has to figure it out. I mean, are they walking into A1 Italy or to freaking Vakif Bank? No. I think that would have been a bit of a shock to the system, perhaps. But I am impressed, very impressed, with how they have made the transition. It's not that I expected, again, I said that the veteran players, like, they're on their way out. They're not putting up numbers or like they used to necessarily. But yeah, I'm going to go with the rookie angle.
I agree with you on that one. And again, it's similar. Not that I didn't think that those three in particular wouldn't be good in Love in their first season, but I think there's a transition to becoming a pro. I didn't think they would necessarily be relied on quite as much as they have been. And you think that they're playing against better middle blockers more consistently, a little more competition. I think specifically Madison and Franklin, who have generally been more physical than the other players they've played against, would maybe struggle to find a few more angles and things like that. But they've been good and consistent all the way through. And not that I'm surprised they're good volleyball players, but just that they've been this consistent this early in their professional career, I think is surprising. All right, we got one more. Looking at PVF, are you more surprised that Merritt Beeson is nowhere to be found on the individual stats leaderboard? Or are you more surprised that Natalie Foster was an all-star snub?
What stat leaderboard are you talking about?
All of them.
Every single skill?
Beeson is nowhere to be found. Points, kill percentage, anything.
If I have to pick one, I would say I'm probably more surprised that Foster was snubbed for the All-Star game. Coming into the PVF season, I, to be completely honest, didn't expect much from either of those players. Beeson had been in the tank with Nebraska for better part of 2 months almost. So I didn't really think that she would be doing much on the professional level. Natalie Foster, she was a good server for SMU, but I didn't really, her offense and her blocking skills as a middle didn't really impress me all that much. So I didn't expect much from either of them. Fast forward, Foster has put up great numbers in the PVF for her team. So if I take that into consideration, she should have been picked for the All-Star game based on what she has done in PVF. So, I mean, Beeson, from what I've seen, is playing pretty well for her team, but am I shocked that she's not leading in the stats? Absolutely not.
I definitely think Natalie Foster should have been at the All-Star game, but Beeson surprises me more than that. I understand that she didn't have a great end of the college season with Nebraska. For me, looking at her, I thought she had potential. I thought PVF was going to be a really good fit for her, kind of level-wise, and I thought getting out of Nebraska and starting over, that she was going to kind of find her groove again because she's capable of being a good player. I thought when I looked at some of these rosters to begin with that Beeson was going to find her time to shine in this league and in that setting and find her footing after the college season. So, like you said, she hasn't been playing poorly, but I expected her to get to the point where she was going to be a standout for her team. So, that was my take on that one.
I really liked this game.
I'll give you one more bonus question.
Oh, dear. Did you even write it down or just come up with this on the fly?
I didn't write it down. But I'm so similar to kind of the Love rookies. We've seen more and more first-year NCAA graduates making more of an impact in PVF across the board as the season goes on. I don't have a comparison, but how surprised are you that we're starting to see these top college players make a difference in the league, kind of across the board?
I think I'm less surprised in PVF than I am on the Love side of things. I mean, we've talked about this. The college athletes had game experience. They had a season under their belt as they came into these seasons. And I've said it so many times, I do feel like the style and level of play with PVF is like an extension of college. So I'm not as surprised to see that on the PVF side.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that game. If you had fun, we'll put that into the bank of games and we'll roll through this again when I get a few more questions to go.
It is time for listener questions. I'm pulling from the question bank here, everybody. We keep getting some every week, so we love it. Thank you so much. This is a broad question. I'm passing this one to Adam right away. How is men's volleyball different from women's?
Okay, so off the top, two things. One, women are more consistent and they make better decisions than men do.
I mean, in life, basically. Just kidding, but I'm not.
And men are more physical and they have the ability to impact the game in a more meaningful way, but more inconsistently. So what I mean by that is you look at a women's team and you can generally know what you're going to get, right? This hitter hits these angles. They're generally this consistent. This is their style. It's a more consistent product, and you don't generally see one woman dominate a match kind of one time and then not be very good, and then somebody else does it another time. And that lends to it, to the physicality difference between men and women. On the men's side, if you have a player who is just feeling it one day, they can be unstoppable.
But then be absolutely terrible.
Tragic, right? And so you will see in certain matches, one guy just has a great day. Slept well, felt good, jumped well, closed his eyes, swung, scored, 5 aces, 3 blocks, 20 kills. Can't stop him. And then the next night, he's tragic. And so the ability to affect a game in that regard is different than the women's game. And you also see the guys in general try more risky plays. You see guys screaming out of the back row, trying to hit balls on two that were dug. And just there's a different approach to how to score points. And sometimes it works and everything bounces in your favor, and sometimes it doesn't. So that physicality, and for a guy to be on and just be able to score 30 points, there are female players who can do that, but you have more wild cards in the men's game in that regard.
To simplify it even further, I would say the women's game is much more ball control focused because women are inherently less physical than men. You're not seeing the same power. You're not seeing the same angles being hit necessarily, the same height on the attack. So that brings the defense into the game a lot more. So that's why you see extended rallies. With men, it is sheer physicality and power. You see them bombing serves at each other. You see the attacks are so dominant. Like if a team is in system in the men's game, they're scoring. So, and that's why the rallies are so much shorter. So you see, for me, a huge difference is like the ball control style versus power.
So I think you're uniquely situated to answer this question. Is there a big difference between indoor and beach volleyball? Can a player who's good at indoor transition smoothly to playing the beach or vice versa?
There is a huge difference between indoor and beach volleyball. I learned the hard way that they are two completely different sports. Beach volleyball is not just indoor played on sand. That's what I thought when I started, and boy, was I wrong. So they are completely different. Even the technique in how to do certain skills, in particular blocking, how you approach, the jumping style, the setting. If you grew up playing indoor and you want to play beach effectively, you have to retrain your body to learn those new skills. The strategy is completely different. You cannot compare them. The only thing they really share in my mind is like the bump set spike aspect and like the name volleyball. Other than that, very different. As far as can a player who's good at indoor transition smoothly to the beach? Yes, it has happened. Would I say it has happened smoothly? No. I think you also can't compare like the 80s, 90s era to today. Like back in the 80s and 90s, you had guys like Mike Dodd, Karch Karai, St. John Smith, who went back and forth no problem. The game has completely changed since then. It is 100% different than it used to be. So I would say if you're looking at present day, it is very difficult for players to transition from indoor to beach and vice versa. The skill sets are completely different. It is very rare to see a good indoor player. And by good, I mean like top level, not like you play club volleyball, have success on the beach. And I think it's even more rare to see a beach volleyball player have any type of success indoor. It's possible, but as I said, the skill sets and the techniques are so different that it does require a lot of time and patience. Mind you, I'm talking about this from like World Tour Olympic level. If you're going out and playing with your friends, 100% you can make the transition. I am talking like at the highest level of both sports. So keep that in mind. But I think if you're playing recreationally, 100% you can make the switch. Kind of building off of that question, our next one is, why do you think the San Diego Mojo doesn't play Sarah Sponsel? They have an Olympian on their bench and they aren't using her in any capacity aside from the occasional double sub.
So I think this comes back to what you said in terms of the games being completely different. So while Sponsel is an Olympian and she has those intangibles that she's learned to perform at a high level, she probably isn't running the offense that San Diego wants to run. So having her on the team in the regards of, hey, this is how you work at practice, this is how you train, you know, all of those things that she's put a ton of work into to make it to the Olympics in beach volleyball, those intangibles are translatable to the training environment, but not necessarily on the court in a play style. And so, you know, obviously without having seen her at practice or see her play, my initial instinct is she's just not delivering a ball consistently to all of the different hitters. Like in beach, you're setting one person. And so, you know, for those reasons, that would be my guess. She's just not delivering either A, the decision-making from an offensive standpoint, or B, the consistency of location for her hitters that move her in front of their current setter.
And I mean, again, if you want to talk about her style of play on the beach, she dug balls because she was relentless. She maybe didn't always make the best reads. She might have been out of position, but she worked really hard and sacrificed her body to get touches. You can't get away with that indoor. You need to be able to set up around the block. You need to be in a good position because the ball is coming so much faster at you that you can't make up being out of position, or you can't run around trying to get touches. Like, you have to be incredibly disciplined in indoor, particularly from the defensive side. And given her beach style, does it translate? I don't know.
Well, and let's be honest. How long did she go without playing indoor? Was it 5 years, 6 years? And
yeah.
It's hard to not do something at a high level and then switch right away. Do I think that maybe she could get there by the end of the season, by next year, with her work ethic and, like you said, her determination? Maybe, but she's clearly not there yet, according to the coach. Our last question has to do with a specific player. So what do you think about Morgan Hentz staying in the PVF? She's obviously a prospect for USA as she was a first alternate. We've talked about PVF being maybe less competitive than Love, and less competitive than being overseas. Do you think she should stay there, or what's her kind of next progression?
It's so hard to know because you don't know what contractual agreements were in place. You don't know Did she have an advocate to, you know, present her as an option to Love? Did Love show any interest in her? Like, it's just really hard to know. And I know we've mentioned this so many times with Love. Like, so many of those players have really big Instagram followings. So, like, you look at the backup libero for Houston. Is Morgan Hentz better than her? Hands down. But this girl has 17 million Instagram followers. And I think in Love trying to build their brand, that kind of takes precedent in some situations. I don't know. Maybe she feels loyalty to PVF because she played with them in their inaugural season. Like, again, she's very good. I think she's probably higher than the PVF level. I mean, she has played overseas already. But maybe there's some personal attachment or Love wasn't interested. Like, I really don't know. I do think she's very good. She was the alternate for the U.S. Olympic roster. So building on the question, this person also asked, past Justine Wong Arantes, who will be the next libero? Could she still be in the conversation? I think she has a chance, but I also think Lexi Rodriguez is coming up. If Lexi Rodriguez can get some playing time somewhere, I think she could make a push for that spot. But I wouldn't take Hentz out of the conversation. Yes, she's playing in a lower level league. I hope she can play at a higher level. Maybe she doesn't want to. Maybe she wants to stay home. I have no clue. But I wouldn't take her out of the conversation. I think she's still in it.
The other thing to note about that is it's really hard for liberos to get contracts just because a lot of, especially leagues overseas, you have foreign limits and you can get local liberos. You're not going to spend one of those roster spots necessarily on a libero. And so the options for those players can sometimes be super limited and you have to take what you get and work on your game.
Well, and liberos are the lowest paid position in volleyball. I mean, foreign teams, they invest in foreign point scorers. In their view, I understand everybody has a role, but in the owner's view, those are the people that help you win scoring points. So it's tough to get a roster spot and it's tough to make money as a libero. Thank you so much for everybody who has submitted questions. As I say every week, I have all of your questions written down. We will get to them all eventually, but we really enjoy this kind of engagement with our listeners. So please keep these questions coming.
All right, let's look forward to the upcoming week. So if we look at Love, the head-to-head match is going to be on Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern, and that's going to be between Houston and Salt Lake. The weekend with Love is in Madison, so hopefully we'll see a spark for them playing at home. That's going to happen on Friday and Saturday. Those matches will be on Love Live or on the Women's Sport Network this week. In NCAA men's action, we're going to head to the East Coast, and on Thursday at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern, Lewis is going to play Loyola Chicago, which should be a really good game. Thursday and Friday at 9 p.m. Eastern, Grand Canyon plays Pepperdine, and on Saturday at midnight Eastern and Sunday at 10 p.m. Eastern, Hawaii is going to play UC Irvine, which I have that circled in my calendar.
We're on Pacific time, so it's not quite that late. Still past my bedtime.
But I think UC Irvine needs to have a good week. I think Hawaii is incredibly talented. I think that's going to be a really good match.
I'm excited to see that game.
100%.
And don't forget, Women's Champions League Round 1 quarterfinals are on Eurovolley.tv on Wednesday. It'll be midday-ish in North America.
Pop up your second monitor at work. Put the game on. Pretend you're working. It'll be worth it, I promise.
That's what Adam does all the time.
If we look at PVF, Thursday, 8 o'clock Eastern, Omaha plays Orlando and Vegas plays Indy. We'll be looking for Vegas to rebound, see how they play on that one. And the Omaha-Orlando match, two top teams in the league, that should be a good one.
That concludes this week's episode of Volley Talk. There's always something shaking in the volleyball world, and we hope you enjoyed this little fix. Be sure to follow the show so you don't miss any updates, and we'd be so grateful if you'd leave us a 5-star review. You can also find us on Instagram at volleytalk_podcast. If you have a topic you want us to discuss, be sure to let us know by reaching out to us on Instagram or at info@sarahpavin.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back next week.